And hello and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 8th, 2014. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest for the entire hour is T. Jefferson Parker. He's the author, a three-time Edgar winner, and the best-selling author of numerous novels, including Laguna Heat, The Famous and the Dead, and Storm Runners. Alongside Dick Francis and James Lee Burke, Jeff is one of only three writers to be awarded the Edgar Award for Best Novel more than once. He's here primarily today to talk about his new release, Full Measure, and I should mention that he's an alumni of UC Irvine, so he's not here on the premises, but his voice is, and I'm so happy that it is. Hi, Jeff.
Well, hi, Barbara. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, good. Things are good.
So tell me about this new book. This is a departure from the crime fiction you've been writing.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's this is my 21st novel, and it's my first literary novel, as opposed to a mystery or thriller, exactly as you said. The story kind of presented itself to me because of where and where I live and the time that I've been living here. And as the story kind of gave itself to me through my little adopted hometown of Fallbrook here, it became apparent quickly that it wasn't really a mystery or thriller that I was dealing with, and that I was going to have to write a different kind of book if I wanted to tell the story that was that I was seeing. And so that's kind of the genesis of it. And I, you know, kind of argued with myself a little bit about whether or not I should tackle such a thing. And in the end, I think that it turned out to be a decent book, and I'm glad I took the chance. And, you know, I got my fingers crossed that people will like it.
Well, you just got a wonderful review in, in a lot of papers, actually. And I guess the AP Wire Service put it out, and it's an excellent review.
Yeah.
It's T. Jefferson Parker, known for his crime novels, delivers an emotional and gut-wrenching literary departure that's miles away from what his fans and readers would expect in Full Measure. And it goes on from there, and so you must be pretty happy about this.
Yeah, I was really, really encouraged by that. It was great to see.
So when you then were struck with the story, when the story began coming to you and you knew that it couldn't be another crime novel, how was that to go, well, you know, I'm going to write something different this time? I mean, did you have to argue with your agent as well or your editor?
Yeah, first I had to argue with myself, and then I had to argue with everybody else, you know, and sort of play my, you know, put my cards out on the table a little bit. The book kind of evolved over time, starting like 2010, say, when I started seeing the young Marines coming back through Camp Pendleton. I saw a lot of them because Fallbrook, where I live, abuts Camp Pendleton. So I'd see these guys downtown at Albertsons and the gas station where I go to, whatever, and started talking to them and all, the nosy critter that I am. And so as the book evolved around talking to these guys and then took off from there, I told my agent that I had this idea for a book, and he was kind of cautiously optimistic about it. He could tell I was very enthused, though. He said, well, it'll be hard to sell. I think I can sell it, but I think I can do some good with this book. It'll be hard. Hollywood will run for the hills, and nobody in Europe will buy it. Other than that, I can tell that you love the material, and I would love to get this book published for you, because he's a real Jeff Parker fan, and he's real committed to my career. So he was encouraging. I talked about it with my wife a lot. You know, we're sort of a team here doing things together, as all, you know, married people do. And she finally thought that it would be a great idea too. And talked to some friends, and next thing you know, I was off and writing. And it was really kind of interesting because I kind of moonlit when I wrote this book. I was under contract to write thrillers back in 2010. I had a couple of more books to write, and so I wrote Full Measure in my spare time. It was kind of like, you know, in between drafts of thrillers, and when there was a down day or week or two or whatever it might be, I wrote this on the side with no contract and no publisher really chosen yet or anything like that. So it was kind of very much a spec project for me, and that's both it's both very liberating and it's kind of scary at the same time, especially when you're working outside of your genre.
It must have been a certain freedom in that too.
Yeah, a great freedom, a wonderful a wonderful feeling. Sometimes it felt to me like, I was sitting here in my little writing studio and a great big, window had been opened and a big breath of fresh air, had come through, because it was so, it's so different to write a literary novel as opposed to a genre novel, because the forms are so different, and it's liberating, and it's intimidating at the same time. And I had really no idea if I could pull it off until the book was over and was done. And I thought when the book was done that it was a good book, and a book worth writing, and a book worth reading.
Hmm. Now, why did your agent say he couldn't sell it in Europe, or no one would buy it in Europe?
He said that Europeans don't love American stories necessarily. They like cowboys and Indians and outlaws and stuff like that, the West, if you will. But contemporary American tales dealing with kind of our society now. The politics, the divided politics, recessionary economy. Young men, women coming home from the wars and all. He says it's not the kind of thing that's going to set the European book market on fire.
Hmm.
Yeah, he's over there right now in Frankfurt. At the the biggest book festival and the fair in the world, trying to see if we can find some European publishers.
Interesting. Well,
yeah.
talk to me about the point of view characters, because you have one main point of view character, Patrick, but then you have a couple of other point of view characters that are present and maybe don't take up as much page space, but take up as much mind space, perhaps. and talk about how you came up with this, with the multiple point of view, why you wanted to do that.
Well, I'll tell you, at heart, I think all extraneous or all, sort of newsworthy things aside, this really is kind of a brother's story, and I wanted it to be from the very beginning. I've always loved the, stories of brothers, starting with the Old Testament forward. I loved Cain and Abel and Jacob and Esau and all that. I love brother stories, and so I wanted to do that. So I thought it would be important to make sure that the brothers were kind of equally weighted. Patrick is the younger brother, and he comes home from Afghanistan as the book opens, very first scene, and he is met at the airport by his older brother Ted, who is not a Marine at all. He's kind of a dreamer. He's kind of a hard luck case. He's a stay-at-home guy, and he's always got one project going or another, but he's kind of Patrick's opposite in a lot of ways. They're physically not similar. They're mentally very different, emotionally different, and yet they're brothers, and they love each other very much. And so the story's about them, and I had to get Ted in there. And then the other viewpoint character is a woman named Evelyn Anders, and professionally she's a wealth manager, a financial advisor, if you will. And but the hat that she wears in the book, most importantly, is that she is the mayor of Fallbrook, the town where the story takes place. And Fallbrook actually doesn't have a mayor, because Fallbrook really isn't a city, it's a county. So we have no city council and we have no mayor. So I was free in my imagination to make up Evelyn and put her in this imaginary mayor's office, if you will. I created a city hall and all that kind of good stuff, because one of the things that I really wanted to get to in this book in a dramatic and fun and interesting way was the very divided politics that America has right now, the far right and the far left and the inability and unwillingness of people to compromise and come together in the middle. Anyway, I wanted to be able to approach that through a person, a character who could be dramatic, and that's Evelyn. She's the mayor, and she's besieged on all sides by these, different people who want different things. And I was able to open up, kind of almost symbolically, through this small town politics and this little mayorship and this little city council, I was able to kind of address American politics, the larger stage of American politics, by staying small. And that's one of the things the book really kind of is about to me. It's really a book about Main Street America. And I was able to get to Main Street America through Fallbrook, which is, the town where it takes place, and also through Evelyn, who is nominally in charge of this chaotic little town.
Hmm. I was worried for her.
Me too. I didn't think she was going to make it there for a minute.
I didn't either. I was a bit worried. This would be a wonderful time to hear you read.
Oh, let's do it.
Okay. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with T. Jefferson Parker. His new book is Full Measure, published by St. Martin's Press.
Let's see. I'll read. I'm going to read the opening part of the opening scene, and it will set the stage, and Yeah, we'll set the stage. You'll see what the deal is. Okay, this is right from the top, chapter one. The camel spiders of Afghanistan were the size of his hand, but they couldn't kill his young, strong body. Neither could the little saw-scaled vipers that were almost invisible on the sand and crawled into his bedding at night. The heat of the summer fighting season couldn't kill him, and not the winter cold that barreled down the mountains, heavy as a freight train, straddling them where they slept or did not sleep, on the ground behind the HESCO blocks, or on rooftops, or hunkered 10 to a room at base. The skinnies couldn't kill him with bombs hidden in the rocks or buried along the roads, nor with grenades launched from the hills or mortars fired from behind the ridgelines. Not with their AKs or sniper rifles or aged, wired-together long guns left over from other wars in another century. Not with knives or hatchets or sticks. Nothing could kill him, so Patrick Norris did the killing until they sent him from Sangin back to San Diego in the fall, a free man, 22 years old, wounded on the inside only. He arrived at Lindbergh Field, and when he walked into the terminal, people set down their bags and clapped. He nodded once and slung his duffel over his shoulder, kept his eyes ahead. As he washed his hands in the restroom, an older man at the sink next to him looked at him in the mirror. Afghanistan? Yes, sir. Thank you. You're welcome, sir. Headed home? Yes, Fallbrook. The man passed a gnarled hand over the faucet sensor, and the water sprayed out. I hear the fire was bad there. When the flames hit the grove, you can still see the smoke in the north. I know. I was in Korea, 51 and 2. Maybe I should thank you. Now the South Koreans have a better health care system than we do. We're 23rd in the world. It's all changed for the worse here. The country, the people, the government, everything's gone bad. I hope you're wrong. It doesn't matter what you hope. Maybe you don't know Jack, sir. I know it when I see it. Well, thanks again. Patrick Norris is his name. Patrick rode the outdoor escalator down, the sun at his back, and the warm on his desert camo, his duffel riding the step behind him. To the south, the downtown high-rises and yachts bobbed on a spangled bay. He thought of all the fish under that water. The colors dazzled him. He had not seen anything like this for more than a year, and he felt the salty breeze on his face and held in a lungful of good American air. Smelled like heaven. Like safety, Patrick thought. Finally. Finally. He counted his blessings. Arms and legs still attached, blood contained, brain working. He closed his eyes and thought of Myers and Wayne, and they and the many ghosts in his heart rose and hovered.
Thank you so much. That was T. Jefferson Parker reading from Full Measure. Was this always the beginning? I always ask you this, and I'm asking you again. Was this always the beginning of the book?
No, it wasn't. That's a good question. That first big chapter, the paragraph that I read with the camel spiders and nothing being able to kill him, that paragraph is what takes up almost the whole first page. But that was the last paragraph of the book that I wrote. The original draft up until the very end was Patrick at the airport at Lindbergh Field coming in and having the people clap for him and then encountering the old guy washing his hands. So, that last paragraph just kind of came to me at one point very late in the going, and I thought, well, yeah, this is the way to frame the book. This is where the book actually starts. So that paragraph was the first paragraph, the last one I wrote.
Mm. Yeah, I love that, and it just kind of drives home the idea that when you're writing a draft, how it's probably more important to kind of keep going through and to the end and see what you have, and then sometimes the endings do come first, huh?
Yeah, that's a really good point for any, you know, any student of writing, you know, young, old, beginning, middle, or whatever. It really is, I think, important to push through, like you said, and get your draft done as best you can, and yet always, you know, remain open to the idea that, you know, things can change, and you're a writer. Writing really is plastic and changeable, and it's like clay. You can really form it to your own desires, you know, as long as you you're careful and you know, prudent about it.
Hmm. I know you always do a ton of research for your novels, and so I'm curious. This one obviously was well researched, and I want to talk about that. But before we do, when do you stop researching and start writing, or are you researching throughout?
You know, I'm kind of an as I go person. Mm. You know, as needed researcher. I'm always like like you and probably every other writer in the world. I'm always extremely anxious to get going. You know, I just can't wait to get that story started. And yet there is a time for that, and there's a time not for that. And so I'll do enough research to get me comfortable with where I'm going, and at least on the first page of the book. But then I'm kind of an opportunist. You know, like on this book, for instance, I became interested in Afghanistan and our Marine Corps for the reasons I said earlier, because I saw these young guys coming back and started talking to them just on the street here in Fallbrook. And you know, one thing then leads to another. So I began reading about the war and about previous wars, you know, you start your research that way. And then I started going out to Pendleton and meeting these guys, and we were talking about writing, and I taught some classes for the wounded warriors and some guys out of Pendleton and all. And so one thing kind of led to another. And whenever you come to a part in the book where you just know that you don't know enough to write the scene, then that's when I'll stop. And I'll have to go out and get my research done.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I saw in the back of the book in the acknowledgments that you visited some vet groups.
Yeah. I'm still doing that. It's really, really kind of neat. There's several groups that I've talked to and sort of in touch with, and you know, I always tell them sort of the same thing, and whether they're, you know, just back or have been back from other engagements or whatever. Most of the people are young, as you would think. A lot of them are in their 20s and stuff. And I stand there before these returned vets, you know, who've, you know, just back from Afghanistan, for instance, or Iraq. And you know, they're in their 20s. And I just say, you know something, the future of our, you know, our country, certainly, and our writing, which is just a small part of it, but still an important part of it, you know, all of that's going to be up to you. You know, it's not going to be up to me anymore. I'm not the future. You're the future. And I encourage you, please, if you have any desire at all, or think that you have any desire at all, to put the pen to the paper and write something about your life and your experiences, war or not, please do it, because we need your records and we need your voices. And so I try to encourage them to write. And like you would expect, you know, a lot of these guys, men and women who serve in you know, in the battle zone and in, you know, in theater, I mean, they've gone through some really, really, really powerful things, good, wonderful and horrible, and they have stories to tell, you know. So they have this big well of experience and stories and narrative sort of inside them, and the emotions that go with it, but they're not sure where to start, how to get started, or what to do with it all. And so what I try to do is to get them to just get started. I think getting started is the hardest part, you know. Once you get started, you have something to work with, you know. You know, one of these days I'm gonna discover the next Kevin Powers, or the next you know, Phil Clay, or the next you know, Tim O'Brien out there, and I'm gonna watch him write a great story about what he or she has been through, and you know, tell the world what it was like.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. I tend not to read nonfiction about you know, historical events, and I like to read it in fiction. And so in this book, it was interesting learning certain things, and one of them had to do with, or that came through with your setting. And you have Patrick's over there in a flashback, and you talk about the corn, like off to the east, there was corn, high corn that time of year.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that's so interesting. You know, you think about Afghanistan or the whole area, and you think of sand, you know.
Yeah.
you think of barren land and not anything growing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that moment, I love that passage, because that passage was given to me by a young man named Tristan Chun, who was a young machine gunner in Afghanistan and during the battle that I write about, the Battle of Sangin. And anyway, I talked with him at length one day, and he was just talking about his first engagement, and they were walking along. They were newly arrived in Sangin, and they were walking along, his platoon, walking along this dirt road, 611, I think it's called, and all of a sudden they started taking fire from the cornfield. There were the Taliban guys were out there firing at them. So they dove into the corn, of course. These are all young guys, first engagement, you know. Dove into the corn, started firing back, and, you know, emptied their guns and their magazines, pretty much everything. And Tristan said they're all kind of lying there, and they've been blasting away for, you know, as much time as it takes to use most of their ammunition. They haven't hit a single thing. None of them have been hit. And the air is just full of the smell of corn because of all the bullets that had gone through, you know, severing the corn stalks and everything. And I thought, ooh, what a moment. What a nice thing to put in the book. So, of course, that had to go in.
Mm. Yeah, your setting throughout, the setting of Fallbrook as well, is, of course, you know Fallbrook because that's where you are. But it was just interesting to be in that setting. And, you know, the book takes place in Fallbrook after a fire. And we, at least us, all of us in Southern California, are sort of used to these fires anymore, which is, you know, a horrible thing to get used to them. But talk about that, just nailing setting when what you're writing about is where you are, because it seems like it's more difficult to write about setting if you're in it.
Yeah, you know, I've always kind of liked doing that. I'm a setting guy. Way back to my very first book, Laguna Heat, it takes place in Laguna, which is where I was living when I wrote it. And you know, for me, it's two things. One, it's if I'm in a place that I find interesting, great. And then number two is it's easier because you're right there, and I don't have to, you know, go to Paris and live there for a while to write a book about Paris. I get to write about where I am, and I really love that. It's a nice way to live, to sort of feel like you're on assignment in your own little town, you know. I found Laguna Beach to be really an interesting place. I had just moved there when I started Laguna Heat, so it was kind of new to me. Even though I grew up in Orange County, I'd never spent much time there until I was an adult. And so I found Laguna fascinating. And in the same way, when I moved here to Fallbrook many, many years later, it was in the year 2000, I've been here 14 years now, I found Fallbrook the same way, fascinating for completely different reasons. It's nothing really like Laguna Beach, but different. It fascinating in its own way. And so as the story developed, it really kind of came from Fallbrook to me. And this story couldn't take place, I don't think, really anywhere else. This is where that story had to come from. And I love writing about where I am. And I think I hope that setting comes through. What I saw in Fallbrook, what I have seen in Fallbrook over the years is America's Main Street. I mean, you know, there was all this talk about in the 2012 election. It was, you know, Romney and Obama yapping back and forth about Main Street versus Wall Street and all that kind of thing. And to me, Main Street America really lives and thrives right here in Fallbrook. We've got everything going, all these different kind of things. And it was a wonderful sort of, you know, microcosm for the country. So I felt lucky to be here to write this book because it was a perfect place to be. I think if I'd been living in wherever, if I'd have been living in, you know, Colorado Springs, Colorado, I probably wouldn't have seen the story.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. Would have been another story.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take a very short break, so all of you out there, please stay with us. We'll be right back with more T. Jefferson Parker and his new book, Full Measure. Don't go away.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. know, little darling, warm one bed in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And I've been here with T. Jefferson Parker. His new book is Full Measure. Before we bring him back on, Jeff is doing a lot of events in the area coming up. You can find out about those by going to his website, tjeffersonparker.com. And maybe you can come out to the Pen on Fire speaker series on Tuesday and see him or any of the others. He's a great speaker, very generous with the audience, and bring your questions, buy a book. Have a good time. Let's bring him back on. Hey there.
Hey.
So, you know, I always ask you this too. I probably ask everybody. Your titles are typically two words, sometimes more. But usually it seems like the two-word titles. Let's see. I'm looking down the list. There's a few that are three. There's one or two that are four.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think deeply about this, or do they just come to you and you go, that's it, like Full Measure? How did that title come about?
Yeah, I'm completely not premeditated about that, but you're right. If you just look at the stats, the overwhelming majority are two words. In the case of this book, it was, it's a phrase from the Gettysburg Address, which is one of my favorite pieces of writing ever. It's part of the phrase, that last full measure of devotion is part of that last great huge sentence that just sort of wraps the whole address up. And so I thought it just was a perfect phrase, because different measures, you know, full measures from different people in different ways. The book is about not so much sacrifice, but about effort, maybe, you know, desire. To put forth yourself, you know. In Patrick's case, he's a Marine. In Evelyn's case, she's a passionate public servant. In Ted's case, he's kind of a slave to his own confusion sometimes, his own desire for action and celebrity, if you will. So it's about giving a lot of yourself. And so it was not only a phrase that I could crib from one of my favorite pieces of writing, but I thought it was an apt phrase for the book. So I went for it. I went with it, and agent loved it, editor loved it, and it never changed. It's one of the few titles that I think, you know, started that way and ended that way.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. So you said earlier that when I said I was worried for Evelyn, you said you were too. And so I'm curious how much you knew going in. How much, I mean, you had a basic story,
mm-hmm.
but everything else, how much did you scope out before you started writing this?
Yeah, good question. I always have a general idea about where I think the story is going, and I adhere to that idea as long as it works and it looks good on the page, and then I'll start to hit at the plate when it doesn't, you know. And in the case of this book, when I hit the last about maybe 100 pages, when I saw that the end was near, I sensed that the end was near, even though I didn't really know what was going to happen. And when I wrote the scene that, we won't do spoilers, but when I wrote the scene that we're referring to, where Evelyn becomes endangered, say, I really didn't know what was going to go on in that scene until I wrote it. And I wrote my way through it, hoping that I was doing the right thing. And that's what I did with the last maybe, you know, 75 pages of the book that follow. So, you know, it was one of those things where you have a rough idea, but then you kind of work it over, and if you can improve it, you do. In my mind, I played out that scene several different ways, several different times before I decided to go with the one that that I was left with, the one that we read now in the book.
Hmm. Yeah. Always curious. how much is discovery and going back to insert, you know, as you go on and you go, well, if this is happening, then I have to go back 100 pages and make sure this thing happened there.
Yeah, yeah. It's action and reaction and action and consequence. You know, the whole, you know, a novel unfolds very, very, you know, sort of logically when you look at it that way, because you realize that for once this happens, then this has to happen. And once this has happened, then certain things can't happen. So you're kind of picking your way through making these funny little decisions. But each one is important, and each one affects, you know, what comes ahead and must be accounted for by what comes, you know, behind. So you have this kind of complicated series of knots that you're tying and untying as you write a book, and you're kind of feeling your way through it instinctively so that you have less knots to untangle at the end, you know, hopefully.
Hmm. So some of your novels, you've created series characters. Charlie Hood was a series character, mm-hmm. Mercy Rayburn. And so now I'm wondering, I don't remember what we talked about in regards to creating series characters, but I'm curious if they were intentional from the start, or if you got, when you got into those novels, if they, you know, you knew you had to write another one, and then writing a standalone, you know, as you did with Full Measure, do you think, well, maybe I want to bring them back, maybe I want to see what else happens down there, or does it just stop when you go into it? Do you kind of know whether it's going to be a character you're going to continue with or not?
Well, you know, with me, it's been kind of premeditated, Barbara. I did that little kind of trilogy series, if you will, back in the back in the late '90s with Mercy Rayburn, and she appeared in three books, and then and I knew that I was going to write about her again when I wrote about her the first time, because mm-hmm. I'd agreed with the publisher that we were going to do that. And then, you know, later, some years later, I embarked on what became the Charlie Hood series of six books, and that was premeditated also. I when I signed that contract and agreed with my editor what I was going to write, it was going to be a series of books featuring Charlie Hood, a sheriff's deputy slash ATF guy. So in my case, it's been premeditated. Certainly, you know, a writer is almost always free to write that character again. You know, I was tempted to write my lead character from a novel called Silent Joe. I was kind of tempted to write maybe part two of that, but I decided not to. This story, for instance, or specifically Full Measure, I don't think I'll write another Patrick Norris story. I think his story has been told, and I think sometimes the best thing an author can do for his novels, her novels, and characters is just to let them get off stage and let the writer get on with the next thing, rather than beating them up for episode after episode. I think I'm done with Patrick here, and I think he's where he should be. I like the ending in this book. There's optimism, and there's some hope and hopefulness in the book. It's a very dark story in a lot of ways, but it's not a story that gives up in any way on Patrick or what human beings can do. So it's hopeful in that way. I remember I had a really neat conversation with a lady named Barbara Giberson, who's one of the librarians out at Pendleton, and she was one of the ladies who brought me out there to meet some of the troops and give talks and stuff. And we were driving across Pendleton one day in her car, and we were talking about the youth of the returned combat Marines and you know, the many, many cases of really, really high, post-traumatic stress and, you know, bad mm-hmm. behavior and just the general anxiety of things. And she kind of sighed, and I kind of sighed. And I said, you know, that's kind of not the story I want to tell. And she says, good, because I think that if you look around and you talk to these people, yes, there are a lot of guys with big problems, and they're the guys who kind of make the headlines, you know, guys who go ballistic, whatever, can't handle it anymore. But most of these people are finding their way through, and they're going to find their way through. And I hope, this is Barbara talking, I hope that you find a way to, you know, imbue some hope and optimism into your story. I hope that this isn't about, you know, the crazy vet. And I had no intention of writing that story, and I didn't. And so I'm happy that this story kind of addresses the bigger part of the veteran population, which are people, you know, like you and me, or not like you and me, because we haven't been through that. But they're putting one foot in front of the other, and they're trying to make a go of it. And that, to me, is a very human, very common story, and I can't tell you how much I'm pulling for these these young people because they're terrific, and they've come back, I think, which is the whole point of the book. They've come back into a troubled republic. And how do you make heads or tails out of some of the things that are happening in America right now when you've just come back from Sangin and seen a bunch of your buddies get killed? Mm. So, that's hats off to them.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with T. Jefferson Parker about Full Measure. How do you choreograph your day then, work or your week, when you're working? You said you were working on this book basically on spec and most likely writing something else. How do you arrange your time?
I'm simple-minded. I get up early and I go to work, and then I work until 4 or 5, and then I'm done. And I do that Monday through Friday. I don't work on really weekends or holidays or anything like that anymore. My younger son is a junior in high school right now, so because of that, our days start fairly early. We get up as a family, pretty darn early, and, the breakfast and a little bit of chit-chat, and Dad flees out to the office, and I start working, and that's how I get things done. And one of the neat things about being a writer is that you do find yourself faced, blessed with sort of largish blocks of time when you really can't do anything. For instance, when you come to the end of your draft and you're happy with it and you have a deadline to make, you send the draft you've been working on for a year or whatever it is. In this case, it was more like two or three years. Anyway, you send it off to your agent and your editor, if you have one, and then you have to wait to hear from them. And the real prompt ones who are Johnny on the spot will get back to you in a week with notes, but sometimes it'll take 2 weeks. So here you are, the draft is done, you're really pooped, you've come across the finish line, the draft is out of your hair and off your desk for a minute, and you have 2 weeks. Well, what do you do? For the past few years, I've been writing this book, Full Measure, in those kind of weeks off, if you will. And now I'm finding myself, when I have time like that, I'm writing short stories. I'm really starting to get a kick out of writing short stories. I've never written very many of them. So I'm starting to fill my, if I have a week off now, I'll start a short story. Hmm. Kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you about short stories. You're in a few anthologies, including Orange County Noir. And so I am curious about that in terms of, going back to the beginning of your writing career or your time as a student or whenever it was that you started writing fiction. Did you start with short stories back then or did you jump right into the novel?
I jumped right in, Barbara. I wanted to write a book length, a novel length story. So I did. I may have dashed off a short story or two for a creative writing class in college. But really nothing very, very serious. So I went straight into novel length stuff. I thought that was my calling. And I thought for a long time that I just wasn't adept, or focused enough a writer to write short stories because they are very, they're short and you really have to put a lot of stuff in there and you really have to know what to leave out. And you have to keep this almost breakneck sort of pace going in a short story, even though it's not necessarily action. It has to be very concentrated, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I never thought that was me until I spent a little time a few years ago. I found myself a little time starting to write short stories, and I'm just really enjoying the form now. It's really kind of fun. The first few that I wrote, a few years ago were commissioned, if you will, by organizations that I belong to, like the Mystery Writers of America, MWA, and the International Thriller Writers. What they do is they'd ask me for a short story. They go, well, write us a short mystery or short story of some kind, and we'll put it in our anthology along with a bunch of other writers, a bunch of mystery writers, like for MWA, and then they'll publish it for a profit and make money, and the money will go back into the club to keep the organization going, So I would always say yes, because I'm members of these organizations, even though I didn't really fancy myself a short story guy. So after doing, several of those sort of obligatory short stories to, take one for the team kind of thing, I found myself really liking it and really liking the freedom and the surprise that a short story can be for you, because talk about not knowing what's going on. You started on a Monday, it's done on a Friday, and you've written the short story that didn't exist before. It's like a whole journey has been crammed into 4 days or something.
How so true. And yeah. I made a mistake earlier. You wrote the intro to OC Noir, but you have a story in San Diego Noir. Is that right?
Yeah, I got one in San Diego Noir. I don't think I was able to write one for Orange County. I was under deadline. Something happened at the time. I was just swamped during that time. But I did have time at the end of it to write the intro,
yes.
The book that your story's in, right?
Yeah.
That was Orange County. And then I did two this year, one for ICW, one for NWA. And I've got another couple of stories that I'm kind of working on right now, just when I can, you know?
Mm-hmm. So your BA is from here, UCI. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you ever did the MFA program, did you?
No, I never did the MFA program.
Had you considered it? And what do you think about all the MFA hubbub?
What do I think of the program?
No, the hubbub, just not of this program in particular, just the MFA hubbub that, you know, there's so many writers, you know, think that perhaps, you know, they need to go through a program, an MFA program, if they're going to get published or if they're going to improve. And just curious, you know, you've had a lot of success, just so much success without an MFA program. I'm curious what your take on it is.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, I decided not to go down that road because I was eager to get out of school and kind of get out into the real world, whatever that is. For me, it was waiting tables at the time, and get into the real world and sort of, you know, try to write something. I kind of pattern myself very, very loosely after good old Hemingway, you know, get out of school and go start being a reporter. And mm-hmm. that's what I did. Took me a while to find a job, but I went from college to being a reporter, and I didn't want to go through an MFA program. That said, I've spent a fair amount of time around the UCI MFA program because I know a lot of people in it who have come through it and who teach it and everything. And, you know, observing from the outside, I would have to think that, you know, an MFA program would just be a wonderful stage for any writer to place to stage from. You know, I mean, what an education that is. I've sat in on some classes and listened to Thomas Keneally and listened to, you know, Andrew Weiner out at Riverside and at various, you know, masters, you know, teachers, you know, professors of writing, and they just have so much to offer and so much to say. And I would think that any beginning writer coming up through a program would have to have a really big advantage. You know, on the other hand, if my son, say, for instance, if he wanted nothing more in the world to be a writer, he said, "Dad, I want to be a writer, but I don't want to go to an MFA." I'd go, "Great, you don't need one. Do it your own way.
Mm-hmm.
Either way is good."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a few minutes left with T. Jefferson Parker. Do you go back and reread novels?
Yeah, I do. I have kind of a short list of books that I read every, I don't know, 6 or 8 years.
What are they?
Yeah, what are they?
Yeah.
Well, let's see.
Or what's one or two on the list?
Okay, let's see. Of Mice and Men.
Uh-huh.
Catch 22. Let's see. Panama, Tom McGuane.
Oh, yeah.
Little known novel, but
yeah.
one of my favorites.
Yeah, I love that one.
You remember that book, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll go back to those books every now and then. I think my favorite crime fiction ever, my single favorite crime book of all time is a novel by John Gregory Dunn called True Confessions, 76, mm-hmm. maybe, 78, 73,
yeah.
I can't remember. Fantastically good book. I read that every 10 years. I've read that book again. Jim Harrison, Legends of the Fall. Every
mm-hmm.
5 years, I'll read those three novellas. I just finished reading Legends of the Fall again. So, yeah, that's part of my short list.
And why do you reread?
I just love the book so mm-hmm. much, you know. I love them so much. It's thrilling to read a book where you really you can read the book and then read the book again and then read the book again, and even as a writer still have kind of no idea how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I read Legends of the Fall, the title story, that 90-page novella by Jim Harrison, I still can't figure out how he did it. It's this epic story that he crams into these giant paragraphs. There's hardly any dialogue, and yet he writes this huge, passionate, big screen, you know, sort of love story about these brothers and this woman, and it's incredible the way he does it. And I put it down, and I feel like I've traveled. I don't know. I feel like I've traveled through space and time, and I'm literally exhausted at the end of these 90 pages. And it's just beautiful prose. And I just go, well, I don't know how he did it, but I can't wait to read it again in 5 years. Maybe maybe I'll figure it out by then.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. And I think every time you reread, you at least when a writer rereads, you notice different things, or you're reading, at least I reread for different reasons. I'm studying something, and like you said, trying to figure out how he did it. Well, I'll read it again and try to figure it out next time.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We are moving to the end. We have a few minutes left. On a nuts and bolts organizing level, how do you keep track of things? Do you keep chapters in one file so you can find words, characters, situations easier? Or, you know, how do you keep track of plot and subplot? I mean, do you, you know, sketch these things out on a plot board or?
You know, those are good questions. I've developed a really cool system. It took me a long time to figure it out. But the first big breakthrough after I started working on a computer was I found out that you never divide your novel into files. It's all one giant file. So you can word search through the whole thing. You can go from page 550 to page 2 in two clicks of the keyboard and be exactly where you want to be. And I didn't do that for like 10 years. So I go, oh, that's back in chapter 1. I have to get out of this file and I have to go back into the chapter 1 file. No. Mm-hmm. Get it all down in one file so you can zoom around full blast, front to finish, start to finish. And then the other thing I do is I have a calendar that represents the time when the book is taking place. Just a regular, like a calendar. Sometimes you have to print it out if it's taking place like in 1968 or something. You don't have a handy calendar, but you figure out the exact day of the week and the date that it is, and you write down on that calendar basically what happens in the book, and so that you always know where you are, and you never have to go, shoot, is that 1 week ago or 2 weeks ago when Patrick told the old man that he doesn't know Jack? You know exactly where it happened. It happened on, you know, October 17th, 2012, because it's on your calendar. It'll really help you out.
So as you're writing these scenes, are you jotting things down at that point, or do you do that after you have a draft, or how are you doing that?
I jot things down. I go to the end of my file, you know, end, and I write a line, and then I make my note, and then I go back into the manuscript. And then the last thing that I delete before I send the manuscript off to agent and editor and to my wife is all those notes at the end. And it's funny because the notes get long at one point, and then as I accomplish these little things, these notes at the end, I delete them so that when I get to the end of the book, the notes are almost gone. It's really cool.
So
they kind of vanish because you've taken care of everything.
Right, so you're making the notes at the end of the chapter.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So, I've talked about a lot. Any last words or advice you've received along the way that has stuck with you and been helpful and that you remember at certain times during your day, week, month, year when you're writing?
Well, you know, I always think that the best advice any writer could give to anyone else, or writer or not, really, is to read the great things, read things that make your heart beat hard and well, and read the good stuff, you know, because I think we as writers and as readers, you know, you're only as good as what you put into your system. It's kind of like your mental spiritual diet, you know, your your dietary supplements, whatever. You have to have the right vitamins and the right mix of stuff, and you need to read good stuff. And just speaking personally, when I'm reading something that's really good, which is pretty much all I read anymore, I'm happy in that reading time. You know, I'm looking forward to it. I'm learning from the writer, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, and I just feel edified and like I spent my time wisely when I put down. You know, finish reading a novel like, since you're at UCI, I just finished a novel by an old UCI professor, gone now, bless him, Oakley Hall, The Downhill Racers. Fantastic, wonderful, beautiful little novel. I never read it, just wanted to read it, and I'm reading it again. I liked it so much. So it's one of those novels you finish the last page and then you read the first page and keep going again.
Will you put down books after you've started them?
Oh, yeah, constantly, continually, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, there's just so much good stuff out there. And if something is annoying and you know, poorly done, I can't. Nobody has time to read that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here again.
Thanks for having me, Barbara. You always ask the best questions, and I feel like I'm just kind of having a conversation.
That's what we're doing. And we'll see you Tuesday night at the Salon.
Wonderful. Can't wait.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
That was T. Jefferson Parker. His new book is Full Measure. It's published by St. Martin's, and it is so worth taking a look at. It's just I read all his stuff, as you out there know who listen to the show. He's on with every new book, and he's going to be at the Pen on Fire speaker series on Tuesday night, and you can find out more about that on my website, penonfire.com. We are on Facebook. We have a Facebook page, Writers on Writing, KUCI-FM. And that's it for today. Until next time, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you so much for listening.